Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Andrew Coats, a Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the results of the White House Healthcare Summit and the Democrats' plan to pass reform legislation in the coming weeks. Kevin Camps, with the group Beyond Nuclear, who describes the inherent safety, health, and economic problems with nuclear power, a technology President Obama is now supporting to address climate change. And David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University, who assesses the Justice Department investigation that recommended no disciplinary action against Bush administration attorneys that authorized torture of U.S.-held prisoners. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A new scramble for control of uranium deposits in Kazakhstan is gathering force amongst the world's top energy companies. The drive for uranium in Central Asia is increasingly tense as 53 new nuclear power plants are under construction worldwide, with an additional 500 nuclear power plants on the drawing boards. According to the Washington Post, political intrigue grew in the energy-rich country after the 2009 arrest of Mukhtar Jakashev, head of the state-run nuclear company Kazatomprom. The KNB, the local successor to the KGB, accused the company's CEO of transferring 60% of the company's uranium deposits to offshore corporations that he controlled. In a video posted on YouTube, Jakashev told investigators Russia wanted to orchestrate his arrest to quash pending international deals and prevent Kazakhstan's energy companies from becoming too independent of Russia. Local observers say Jakashev's charges ring true because he was recruited to head the company as a younger generation business leader in a push to modernize the country's post-Soviet economy. His business allies have rallied in his defense since his arrest. In a trip through Latin America, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made a stop in Argentina to offer mediation over the energy dispute between Argentina and Britain over the Falkland Islands, occupied by Britain since 1833. The trip, planned in advance of the massive earthquake in Chile, gained greater urgency when Clinton, who briefly visited Santiago, pledged long-term U.S. assistance. The renewed conflict heated up as a British company is seeking to exploit oil resources in waters off the Falkland Islands. Argentine President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner says Britain does not have the unilateral right to exploit these resources in the disputed waters. In 1982, Argentina's military junta invaded the Falklands after the regime faced a public outcry over mismanaging the economy and human rights abuses. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher sent a naval fleet to retake the Falklands at a cost of nearly 1,000 lives, mostly Argentinian soldiers. Soon afterwards, the Argentine junta fell and civilian rule returned. Conservatives in Britain say the Obama administration has taken a hands-off approach to the Falkland crisis in retaliation over the release of classified information on former Guantanamo Bay detainee Binyam Mohammed, a British citizen. In a resounding victory for anti-nuclear activists, the Vermont State Senate voted overwhelmingly to cease operation of the 38-year-old Vermont Yankee nuclear plant after its current operation permit expires in 2012. The vote in Vermont is the first time in 20 years a public body has decided to close an operating nuclear power reactor. It came a week after President Obama announced over $8 billion in new loan guarantees for construction of new nuclear plants. Vermont legislators voiced frustration about misinformation from the plant's operator, Entergy, and a series of radioactive tritium leaks in recent years. In 2007, one of Vermont Yankee's cooling towers collapsed. Under Vermont state law, an extension of Vermont Yankee's operating license required an affirmative vote by both houses of the Vermont legislature. Unless the Vermont Senate vote is reversed, Vermont Yankee will close in March of 2012. According to the New York Times, Entergy's current decommissioning fund has less than half of the $1 billion needed for cleanup. Radioactive tritium leaks would only increase the cleanup price tag, say plant critics. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
The results of President Obama's February 25th health care summit were predictable. Democrats, and especially Republicans, robotically stuck to scripted talking points aimed at the television audience. Although the meeting of congressional leaders, President Obama, and members of his cabinet was billed as a last-ditch effort to negotiate a bipartisan formula for passing health care reform legislation, the meeting, broadcast live on C-SPAN, only served to provide a platform for posturing in the lead up to the November 2010 midterm congressional election, when supporters of single-payer health reform or Medicare for All were excluded from the summit. Protesters staged their own sidewalk summit outside the official meeting. In advance of the meeting, President Obama presented an 11-page document outlining a proposal to find common ground between the different health care reform bills passed by Democrats in the House and Senate. Among the new planks in the president's plan was the establishment of a panel that will assess insurance company rate increases. Rate hikes became the focus of public anger after Anthem Blue Cross announced premium increases of 39% in California and similar amounts in other states. Overall, the president's plan would cost an estimated $950 billion over 10 years and would extend health insurance to only 31 million out of an estimated 47 million people currently without coverage. With the Democrats' defeat in the Massachusetts special election and the loss of their supermajority in the Senate, congressional leaders are prepared to use the budget reconciliation process to avoid a Republican filibuster in the Senate. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Andrew Coates, an instructor at Albany Medical College and a national board member of the single-payer advocacy group Physicians for a National Health Program. Dr. Coates assesses the results of the White House Health Care Summit and takes a critical look at legislation Democrats hope to pass in the coming weeks.
The proposal stayed well within the bounds of the Senate bill. There were minor sops to the House bill in terms of allowing more of the low-income people to benefit. The major portion of the expansion of coverage, because this is sold by its supporters as an expansion of coverage, the major portion is in a Medicaid expansion, and that would be what we know as a poor program for poor people, patients who have difficulty getting access to care in spite of having coverage because they have Medicaid, taxes upon the states. And of course, the proposal would fund the care of these patients through federal dollars. But the administration of the program would fall on the state governments, and so it wouldn't be completely and totally paid for by the state. And then the second portion would be an expansion of private health insurance, but with a subsidy, so that if you were making more than 150% of the federal poverty level up to 400%, and this was the reconciliation between the Senate and the House bills, then you would be eligible to have a subsidy of taxpayer dollars going to your private insurance premiums in order to make it affordable. So it doesn't make it affordable. It just means that it's like robbing the poor to pay for the poor. I mean, it just means that taxpayers would help you pay your premiums because they can't be made affordable by private health insurance. And we have to be frank. The health insurance industry wrote this bill. It has been what they've been after for a very long time, the individual mandate. They have a product that is very unappealing. It's not affordable. It doesn't work. People think they're covered up until the time they're sick. And then it's a devastating blow to go through all those hassles of trying to get care when you really need it. And so if the government would coerce people to buy that product, that would save the industry. So that's what the industry put forward, and that's what the Democrats and the Republicans are trying to figure out if they can agree on.
Many advocates of passing in Congress this compromise health care reform bill will say the political reality dictates that we have to take half a loaf or nothing at all. And they They maintain that even a flawed bill at this point is better than passing no bill at all, given the urgency. 45,000 Americans die every year due to not having adequate health insurance. And 62% of all personal bankruptcies are linked to medical debt. So people say we got to do something, even if it's not perfect. The old saying, we shouldn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. How do you respond to that?
The question is whether this bill is half or even a quarter of a loaf, or whether it's even progressive. I'm a little bit on the extreme side of the single-payer movement, in that I know that many of my friends and co-workers within the single-payer movement are sympathetic to the idea that this anything is better than nothing. I don't see this as better than nothing. I see this as actually more harm than good. This proposal would strengthen the insurance industry in a way that is unimaginable. Taxpayers over the decade would give the private health insurance industry, one of the most profitable industries in the history of the world, would give over $400 billion in taxpayer dollars to this industry to subsidize their unaffordable, unworkable product that has failed this nation since World War II. And so why would we put the industry in that position of incredible power and place? Why would we enhance its place when it has failed our nation? I don't think that a Medicaid expansion will really help improve the health of the nation. I think that we need a dramatic and radical reform. And I think that single payer is the very least, the very most minimum reform that will improve quality, improve equity in health care, guarantee access, and guarantee choice, and finally, protect privacy between doctors and patients. Because when private health insurance companies stand to make money by getting between myself and my patient, or any nurse practitioner and their patient, any provider and patient, that is when privacy is eroded. It's when the money interest gets between the doctor and the patient. And we can't tolerate that anymore. And the way to remove that is through a single-payer alternative.
Given the fact that President Obama and congressional leaders have really taken single-payer off the table, the Medicare for All option really is not among the pragmatic choices at this moment in on Capitol Hill. What's next for single-payer? What's your group going to be doing in terms of pushing forward with this as an option for the country?
If you look at the history of 2009, we've had an amazing amount of grassroots activity from civil disobedience. Nearly 200 people, in fact, arrested doing civil disobedience for single payer, and just thousands of local activities, literally thousands, and millions of calls to Congress. So we have a movement for single payer. It's not going to go away. It's going to continue to grow, and I have great confidence that we will actually win.
That was Dr. Andrew Coates, an instructor at Albany Medical College, a national board member of Physicians for a National Health Program, and a shop steward with the Public Employees Federation, AFL-CIO. Visit Physicians for a National Health Program website at pnhp.org. President Barack Obama in recent weeks has signaled his strong support for a resurgence of safe, clean nuclear power, touted as a way to address climate change, since the production of nuclear power does not release greenhouse gases. After he praised it in his State of the Union speech in late January, he followed up by proposing a budget that includes $55 billion in federal loan guarantees for companies building nuclear plants. And in late February, he went to Georgia to pledge $8 billion for what he said would be the first nuclear power plant built in the U.S. in three decades. America now gets 20% of its electricity from nuclear power, a ratio that has held steady for at least 20 years. Obama also recently fulfilled a campaign promise to shut down Yucca Mountain in Nevada as the nation's long-term nuclear waste storage facility, citing safety concerns. Instead, he appointed a high-level panel to research alternatives, which includes many key promoters of nuclear power, but no nuclear opponents. Against this backdrop, the Vermont legislature voted last week to shut down the almost 40-year-old Vermont Yankee nuclear plant when its license expires in 2012 due to safety concerns. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog with Beyond Nuclear, a nonprofit group that links the dangers of nuclear power and nuclear weapons. Here he discusses some of the myths surrounding the advertised advantages of nuclear power.
In terms of nuclear being a solution to the climate crisis, we agree the climate crisis is a potential catastrophe that's unfolding on the planet, and that's the very reason that people need to learn all that they can about nuclear power and why it cannot solve the climate crisis. And there's a list of reasons why nuclear power can't solve the climate crisis. The best book that's been written on this subject is called Insurmountable Risks by Dr. Bryce Smith at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. His major arguments are, first of all, that nuclear weapons proliferation will expand dramatically with any kind of expansion of nuclear power. And this is because nuclear power requires uranium enrichment for its fuel, and there's also a proposal to revive in this country reprocessing of radioactive waste. Both of those, enrichment and reprocessing, are pathways to nuclear weapons. So if the United States expands nuclear power, if the world expands nuclear power, these pathways to nuclear weapons will also expand right along with it. And that was their main argument. Probably of equal importance to the climate crisis is the specter of nuclear weapons proliferation, the possibility of nuclear war. That is an equal global catastrophe that could happen. So that's an important point to get your head around. But the other reasons that IEER pointed out that nuclear can't solve the climate crisis is the astronomical cost of new reactors, the long time it takes to build them. The climate crisis will have come and gone before nuclear power shows up. And then some of the other insurmountable risks included the still unsolved, after 70 years of atomic energy, radioactive waste problem. We still don't have a solution. There's also the unsolved problem of accidents and attacks unleashing catastrophic amounts of radioactivity. So Chernobyl and Three Mile Island are the most infamous accidents in nuclear power's history. But there's also the risk of terrorists attacking reactors, attacking high-level waste storage pools. This could lead to Chernobyl-scale or worse atomic disasters here in the United States or elsewhere in the world. So those are some of the reasons that IEER pointed out, but we would add a few. We would add that the uranium fuel chain releases toxic chemicals and radioactivity at every stage. So one stage that's often neglected is uranium mining and uranium milling, and those take place largely on indigenous peoples' lands around the world. And so we find that an unacceptable environmental injustice, that indigenous peoples, oftentimes who don't even have electricity in their communities, are being asked to bear perhaps the worst brunt in terms of health of the entire uranium fuel chain. That's uranium mining and milling, and that's part and parcel of nuclear energy. Another aspect of that toxic and radiological release are the reactors themselves, which routinely and with permission from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission release radioactivity into the environment. So there's a very proper scandal in Vermont about these leaks of tritium and other radionuclides into groundwater. But the thing is, the question that's not being asked very much, if at all, is where would that tritium have gone if it didn't leak into the groundwater? Well, with permission from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it would have been discharged into the air out a smokestack-type structure, and it would also have been discharged through pipes into the Connecticut River directly.
Kevin Camps, I know it often has taken decades to bring a nuclear power plant online once it's been approved for construction, but what about these smaller modular plants that are touted as much quicker to build? Might they be able to tackle climate change in a meaningful way and be secure?
Actually, the small modular reactors, they call them, would be even more astronomically expensive than the large-scale nuclear power plants that are the recipients of these loan guarantees in Georgia at this point, to the tune of $8.3 billion of taxpayer financial risk. The small modular reactors would lose the economy of scale that the large reactors have, and so we're talking about a much higher price tag per unit of electricity. The lead candidate small modular reactor of the past, anyway, was called the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor, and it has been almost entirely abandoned worldwide. And that's because the main selling point for the reactor was that it was supposedly so inherently safe that it would not need a containment. Well, September 11th happened and made the point very clear that, well, it might not be an accident that releases the radioactivity. It might be a terrorist attack by intention. So you might need to protect the core against an intentional attack. Other problems with nuclear power would still be present. The radioactive waste problem would still be there. The radioactivity releases. Really, what it represents is another desperate attempt by the industry to come up with some idea that they can get taxpayer money from Congress for. And that's what the small modular reactor push is all about right now.
That was Kevin Camps, radioactive waste watchdog with the group Beyond Nuclear. Contact them at area code 301-270-2000. 2209 or visit their website at beyondnuclear.org. After a five-year investigation into misconduct by Bush administration lawyers who authorized torture of U.S.-held prisoners, the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility has recommended no disciplinary action be taken. The inquiry focused on two Bush attorneys, John Yoo, who now teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Jay Bybee, now serving as a federal judge, originally recommended that state bar associations undertake a disciplinary review of the two men. But that recommendation was overruled by Associate Deputy Attorney General David Margolis, who stated that the two men had merely shown poor judgment and should not face disciplinary action. In a series of memos written in 2002, Yoo and Bybee provided legal cover to President Bush and Vice President Cheney to subject U.S.-held detainees to waterboarding and other harsh interrogation methods considered war crimes under the Geneva Conventions and U.S. law. During the inquiry, Justice Department investigators encountered serious obstacles, such as a large number of missing emails written by John Yoo and former Bush Attorney General John Ashcroft's refusal to cooperate. If the U.S. government refuses to hold officials who authorized torture accountable, Spanish Judge Baltazar Garzon, who indicted Chile's General Augusto Pinochet in 1998, is prepared to intervene. Garzon is conducting his own investigation of Yoo and Bybee based on the U.S. torture of Spanish citizens held at the American detention camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University, who assesses the Justice Department's investigation and considers the options for holding Yoo, Bybee, and other Bush administration officials accountable for torture.
The Ethics Office wrote a 250-page analysis of the Yoo and Bybee memos, concluding there was misconduct. Margolis wrote a 69-page memorandum arguing otherwise, concluding that it was a close question, but arguing otherwise. Technically, Eric Holder might have overruled him. It would have been tough. So, I mean, the one thing that Margolis does underscore is that, you know, this is not the final call. The final call is ours. It's the judgment of history, and I think that's right. The fact that these lawyers have not been referred for bar discipline doesn't take away our obligation, essentially, as citizens, to condemn what happened and to ensure that the judgment of history is that what these lawyers did was wrong and illegal and should never happen again.
There was a debate, I believe several years ago, where John Yoo was put on the spot about his feeling about torture in a very specific scenario, where he was asked if the president had the authority to subject a detainee's son to having his testicles crushed in order to get the detainee father to talk, to spill the beans about whatever theoretically was at stake. And John Yoo said the president does have the power to do that. I'm sure there's some details there I'm lacking, but maybe you can just talk about the extremity of this guy's views that, you know, determined the policy of the Bush administration, or at least justified it legally during the Bush years.
Yeah, well, you got it. That's what he said. And he said something quite similar to the Office of Professional Responsibility, and it's recounted in these reports. He said they asked him, you know, in your view, could the president order the massacre of a town, extermination of this of the population of a town, if he so chose? And John Yoo said, sure. And I think, you know, Yoo's position is that the president, as commander in chief, exercises literally uncheckable power. It cannot be checked by international law, by the laws of war, even by explicit congressional statutes. And he inserted this argument into the torture memo. The reason the torture memo was written is because there is a statute that Congress enacted that fulfills our obligations under the International Convention Banning Torture, which we were instrumental in drafting and getting other countries to sign, and we signed and ratified. And Congress then made it a crime to commit torture.
As you said before, our nation will be judged by history as to what we do to hold these men to account for what they've done in authorizing torture against international treaties the United States has signed, as well as our own domestic law here. What is our recourse after this Justice Department investigation recommended no disciplinary action? What can we do as a nation? What can Congress do?
Well, Congress can investigate and continue the investigation. One of the things about the Office of Professional Responsibility report is that they didn't have the authority to compel witnesses to testify. So the only people who testified before them and came to talk to them were people who agreed to. And many key people refused to participate in any way, including John Ashcroft, the Attorney General, David Addington, who was Dick Cheney's counsel, Tim Flanagan, who was the White House counsel, all of whom were very closely involved in all this and simply refused to participate. So there are also, mysteriously, John Yoo's emails from the critical time period when the memos were being drafted have allegedly disappeared without a trace. So the judiciary committees of both the House and the Senate could launch an investigation. The intelligence committees could launch an investigation. I think what we need is an independent commission along the lines of the 9/11 commission, which would have the sufficient resources and the power to subpoena witnesses to really get the full story out. I think the Republicans obviously don't want it for obvious reasons, but the Democrats don't seem to want it either. President Obama has said we're going to look forward, not backward. And I think, you know, it's partly because he doesn't want to, you know, have his agenda hijacked. But I think it's also partly because of out of a fear of the Democrats that if they are perceived as going after those who broke the law in our name, they will be portrayed by people like Dick Cheney and John Yoo as caring more about terrorist rights than about our own security. Nothing could be further from the truth, but the Democrats are deeply afraid of that. And so the commission right now, I think, is a long shot, but things can change. You know, new information can come out. There can be things that might push for that. And I think at the end of the day, what we need is some form of official accountability. And in my view, an independent commission would be the best way to do that.
That was David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University and author of The Torture Memos, Rationalizing the Unthinkable. Visit his website at torturememos.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and Real Audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.